This is The Intersection. My name is Mark Riley, and I want to thank you so much for listening to this episode of my podcast. It's been a while since our last episode, and in that time, we've seen a chaotic presidential debate, the passing of a legendary Supreme Court justice, the nomination of a conservative replacement, a stunning lack of justice in the police killing of Breonna Taylor, and to top it all off, the President of the United States has tested positive for coronavirus. Other things have happened, but these are the low points, I think. One hates to talk about Donald Trump under the best of circumstances, at least I do. But in this case, it's turned out to be inevitable. Treating COVID-19 as a marketing and campaign opportunity is an absolute low point in the history of American politics. The man announces a positive test, is sent to the hospital, comes out, and acts as though he was afflicted with a common cold. He seems to have no regard whatsoever for even his fundraisers and staff who may have been exposed to him. Since few others have said it, allow me. Donald Trump seems to be a super spreader of COVID-19. He's gone beyond being a bad joke, and he's got his doctors alibiing for him along the way. I say this because I'm now in England, and it pains me, not because it's Donald Trump, but because it's the President of the United States. It pains me to hear people describe the president of the country I was born and raised in as deranged. And believe me, foreign press, not just here in England, but in other places around the world, are starting to use that term to describe Donald Trump. Let's look at some of the byproducts of this man's positive test. His wife Melania tested positive at the same time he did. His close advisor Hope Hicks was positive, tested positive, that is, before he did. Three Republican senators, Mike Lee of Utah, Tom Tillis of North Carolina, and Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, also tested positive. Former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who helped prep Trump for the shambolic first debate, is also part of the Trump COVID orbit. That would be the same Chris Christie who said, and I'm paraphrasing here, that some lives would have to be sacrificed to restart the American economy. I'm not sure he was thinking of his own life in that instance. Kellyanne Conway and current press secretary Kayleigh McEnany are positive as well, along with anti-immigrant zealot Stephen Miller. There's also Bill Stepien, Trump's campaign manager, and Ronna McDaniel, chair of the RNC. Now, take all of those names, put them together, and what do you got? Donald Trump's inner circle, all testing positive for COVID-19. Several reporters who work in D.C. and work in relatively close proximity to the White House have also tested positive. We don't even know whether White House staffers have been offered tests, much less how many whose names we don't even know may have tested positive. That's because there's apparently no or little track and trace system in place to contact people who came in contact with the president. Talk about a hot mess. It's predictable that Trump supporters would prefer to talk about something other than his stunning irresponsibility. They bleat and they caterwaul about how Trump's detractors are disrespecting both him and the office of the presidency by wallowing in his distress or making fun of his distress. This, in my judgment, is a clear distraction from the issues that are at hand at this point. I am totally ambivalent. It's just me. Ambivalent about this president, his supporters, and his detractors who decide to make fun of him. There's an election coming up and a Supreme Court nominee who has no business being considered until after that election is settled. Those things and others are far more important than Donald Trump's feelings, if he has any. His tax returns, those that haven't been exposed by the New York Times, may be exposed again, this time by the Manhattan DA. We'll see if his boastful posture carries him through the October 15th debate. And it doesn't look at this point as if that debate is in fact happening. The events of the past few days are simply mind-boggling. And I say that as someone who covered politics for a very, very long time, certainly on the local New York City level, and to some small extent on the national level as well. This is mind-boggling. People around the world, notice I said people, not heads of state, although I'm sure some of them are doing it too. They're just shaking their heads. Many cannot believe that America elected a reality TV host to govern the most powerful nation on earth. Most polling, for what it's worth, has Trump down by double digits. But remember, 4 years ago, Trump was down in the polls too. So, you know, you have to take the polling with a grain of salt. And certainly Trump supporters are taking the polling with a huge dose of salt. Whatever you do, do not bet the store on polling. You know, lost or challenged ballots could cost Joe Biden in some key states and thereby cost him the election. Don't bet the store on these late polls. Don't even bet the store on the polls that happened the weekend before the November 3rd election. There are going to be a lot of lost ballots. There are going to be a lot of ballots that are challenged at the polls. Some of these Republican governors are actually bringing out law enforcement to stand at the polls and, where need be, to challenge voters. That's called voter suppression. There's also the issue of down-ballot contests, which can cost the GOP the Senate if enough people do, in fact, turn out to vote. It looks like, anecdotally, that there will be a large, large voter turnout. No matter what, complacency is the Democrats' worst enemy. I've asked the question before, are the Democrats up to win this? I truly hope so. Not because I'm so enthusiastic about their platform, but because I'm not at all sure the United States can stand 4 more years of Donald Trump. It might be a losing proposition were he to get reelected. And we would then have a Supreme Court tilted 6-3. In favor of conservative right-wing justices. That has daunting, daunting implications going forward. This is where America is in the last quarter of 2020. It is amazing to contemplate. I'm sure at the beginning of the year, nobody thought we'd be in this place. Donald Trump is now running around saying he's well enough to go on the campaign trail again. Nobody will say for sure whether he is. His doctor says, oh, he's much better. He's okay. But even his doctors don't know. Trump is trying to sham. He's trying to bluster. He's trying to bully his way through the greatest health crisis of his life. And we'll see whether or not he can get away with it. Now, to be honest, I'm not sure his supporters would disbelieve anything he said between now and Election Day. I just don't. He said, after the debate commission decided that there would be a virtual debate in or around October 15th based in Miami, he said he wasn't going to participate. Joe Biden said he'd participate, but Trump wouldn't. And part of the reason why, at least in terms of his public statements, is because people would have the power to turn him off. People would have the power to shut him down, which obviously Chris Wallace didn't have during the first debate. We shall see. What a hot mess. When we come back, the vice presidential debate, pluses, minuses, and again, will there be a second presidential debate? This is The Intersection. We ducking all on you. Welcome back to The Intersection. My name is Mark Riley, and again, thank you so much for listening to this episode. So what are we to make of a debate whose most memorable moment is the landing of a fly on Mike Pence's head? That's right, a fly on Mike Pence's head. The vice presidential throwdown turned out to be a relatively civil affair. Kamala Harris scored early, following a reported script that Velcroed Pence, the vice president, to the Trump administration's feeble response to the coronavirus. She did miss on a couple of issues, like taxes, fracking, and adding seats to the Supreme Court, which, by the way, she shouldn't have committed to, given the administration's rush to confirm a successor to the great Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Pence, on the other hand, relentlessly defended Trump's record on almost everything, while managing to go over his allotted time over and over. Of course, the weight for that has to fall on moderator Susan Page. She seemed to have trouble getting both combatants to directly answer her questions without descending into talking points. There's a reason why I detest that term, and last night was it. Now, if you consider that vice presidential debate to be a wash, and by a wash, I mean didn't move the needle, didn't cause Kamala Harris's support to erode, didn't cause Mike Pence's, and by inference, Donald Trump's support to erode. That means everybody will be focused on October 15th if it in fact takes place. Should Joe Biden agree to debate a COVID-infected Donald Trump face-to-face? And there's a reason, by the way, that we have not heard of a negative test on the President of the United States since the positive test, which was announced last Thursday night, Friday morning. My guess would be if he had tested negative, we'd all know about it, which means he is most likely still positive. I mean, if I were Joe Biden, I would have to go within that particular context. I don't know how you would think otherwise, given the circumstances. Now, without the strictest protocols in place for a face-to-face debate, which the commission has already said they don't want to do, Biden would seem to be putting himself at great risk. Donald Trump seems absolutely not to care. In fact, he's now saying his infection is a blessing from God. I'll repeat that. A blessing from God. He touted Regeneron as a cure, ignoring for the moment that he may have a stake in the company that makes it. He promised hundreds of thousands of free doses the manufacturer says aren't even available yet. And there are also questions about Trump's use of steroids. This is especially true after he inexplicably shot down talks with Democrats over a COVID-19 stimulus bill. Even his Republican supporters were kind of gobsmacked by that. And I mentioned earlier how this man is viewed around the world. You know, in addition to deranged, he's also, ironically enough, become a form of entertainment, which of course probably isn't too big a reach since that's where he came from, the world of entertainment. He's a buffoon to be mocked as he has mocked others since he became president. Unstable is another term that's used over and over. And interestingly, it seems though Donald Trump doesn't care one way or the other. Now, while we're on the subject, and I could be subject to correction on this, how come nobody, least of all the president himself, has mentioned his wife? Melania Trump tested positive, and yet the man has not yet, as far as I know, uttered a sentence with the word the first lady in it since announcing that they were both positive. Wonder why? I know I do. So we'll see if Donald Trump continues to stand his ground, and now we know out of his own mouth why he doesn't want to do a virtual debate. Because he believes that he will be at a disadvantage, that he'll be able to yell and scream, and someone will be able to cut his microphone. Again, something didn't happen during the course of the first debate. Now, if you were Joe Biden, would you debate this man face to face? Biden has already agreed to do a virtual debate. Now, I don't know whether the debate commission might then say, if Trump continues to hold fast and say he's not going to do it, maybe they'll just let Biden talk and answer questions for whatever time the debate is allotted. It would be a temptation. I don't think they would necessarily, because everybody would start screaming how unfair it was. But it's Donald Trump's decision. Rightly or wrongly, for better or for worse, the decision as to whether or not to debate is now completely up to Donald Trump. And why he would think that a debate commission, in its right mind, would agree to a face-to-face debate with a man who has not yet tested negative for COVID-19. That's like malfeasance. It's not malpractice because they're not doctors, but it would be malfeasance. And I would think even Trump's yes man doctor, Conley, I guess his name is, I guess he might even say, yeah, you know, that might not be the greatest of ideas. We'll see. I'd like to know what you think. Leave a comment on my Facebook page, or you can email me at mark@markreillymedia.com. mark@markreillymedia.com. And finally, over here in England, there are calls to close pubs and restaurants again. Scotland has already done so. If COVID-19 cases are rising where you are, what do you think your leaders should do? This is The Intersection. Welcome back to The Intersection. My name is Mark Reilly. The final piece of this episode has to do with the land across the pond, for those of you in the States, and for me, it's where I am, the United Kingdom. I've begun to immerse myself, somewhat, in British politics. The UK is currently facing a rapid rise in the number of positive coronavirus cases, particularly in certain parts of the country. This has caused the First Minister of Scotland, Nicola Sturgeon, to impose strict new measures on pubs and restaurants, including a 6 p.m. closing time on all indoor establishments. The rest of the UK, including England, is contemplating its own severe restrictions. What has to be understood is that pubs in the UK is like baseball and apple pie to the US. It's part of the UK's national identity, not to mention a big part of the country's small business economy. Pubs cater to the young and to the old, the working poor and the not so poor. That is, to a wide diversity of society within the United Kingdom. During the earlier lockdown, the British media was full of stories detailing how upset people were with pub closings, and how owners and landlords were afraid they wouldn't reopen when the lockdown ended. And some of them, in fact, did not. Now it's happening all over again. And let's be clear, so people understand this. Pubs are different than bars, okay? I mean, they both serve alcohol. And certainly if you were in the States and walked into what is in the UK a pub, you just say, well, hey, it's a bar. Pubs in the UK, however, are miles away from bars in the U.S. Pubs here are homes away from home, and that's in a way that a bar never could be. Now, full confession, I have to admit, I am not a big drinker. The idea of downing more than a pint of beer would for most of my life have been laughable, and I won't talk about that time when I did use to down a pint of beer. Yet here I am across the pond, and I actually have a favorite pub. If you had asked me 6 months ago if I supported a second lockdown if the infection rates for COVID-19 got high, I would have said absolutely. Now, I'm not so sure. Having spent quality time in a couple of pubs, I understand much better their role in British life. They're part of this nation's collective DNA, never mind the numbers of people they employ. But there are other basic questions that ought to be answered before they go into a lockdown and shut pubs yet again. And I'm saying this as an outsider. I have to be honest. But from the way the government treats pubs, bars, and restaurants, you'd think they'd have tracked huge numbers of infections directly to them. As far as pubs are concerned, it's estimated only 5% are directly traceable to the pubs. I'm talking about 5% of those infected with COVID-19. The fact is, Britons are far more likely to get infected at home by means of a family member than they are in a pub. But of course, no government can regulate or legislate you out of your own home. Now, can they? I finally began to understand pubs when I went to one to watch a soccer match. Here, of course, it's called football. And if you don't want to pay through the nose to watch a match at home, a pub or sports bar is your alternative. After a couple of trips to my local establishment, they started treating me, an American, a black American, like an old friend. Now when I go, they find me a perfectly socially distanced seat, and I'm greeted with, "You okay, mate?" For that purely selfish reason, I hope the pubs do, in fact, stay open. Now, as I was writing this, and this is on a very sad note for me, I learned that Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Jim Dwyer, who wrote for New York Newsday, The Daily News, and The New York Times, passed away too young at the age of 63. I knew Jim, didn't know him well, but well enough to know he was one of a handful of journalists, most passed away now, who had his finger on the pulse of everyday New Yorkers, who he wrote about with a unique clarity and a unique style and class. This episode of The Intersection is dedicated to the late Jim Dwyer. Rest in peace. You've done good, my friend. Thank you so much for listening. The executive producer of The Intersection is Kim Jack Riley. Until we meet again, please stay safe.